So, I want you to picture a scenario. It's a Tuesday morning. You're drinking your coffee, you're scrolling through your feed,
And
and
you see a headline that just makes your stomach drop.
yeah, exactly. There's been an incident, maybe a protest turned violent, or, a traffic stop that escalated way too fast.
Right.
The details are messy. The internet is absolutely screaming, and everyone, activists, pundits, your neighbor down the street, they're all demanding the exact same thing.
Release the video.
Release the body cam footage. Right.
Right.
It has basically become this modern reflex. It's the prayer for truth. We have this deep-seated belief that if we can just see the pixels, if we can just watch that MP4 file with our own eyes, we will know exactly what happened. Case closed.
It's a very human reaction. I mean, we're visual creatures,
Yeah.
but here is the hard truth we really need to confront today. In 2026, asking what does the video show is actually the wrong question.
Okay, that feels incredibly counterintuitive.
I know.
If the video is the literal recording of the event, how can looking at it be the wrong move?
Because the video is just the end product. It's the shiny object at the very end of a long, very dark assembly line.
Okay.
The real question, the one that actually determines whether you get the truth or just, a curated narrative, is this: what happened to the file before it reached you?
You mean like did someone edit it, like cut out the bad parts?
No, not even that. I'm
Yeah.
talking about the invisible systems that govern that file from the split second it is born.
The invisible systems.
Right. We are diving into a concept today that, frankly, sounds a bit technical, maybe even boring to some folks, but it is actually the invisible government of the truth.
Okay.
We are talking about metadata.
Metadata.
Yeah.
Okay, I can literally feel people reaching for the skip button right now.
Don't skip.
Seriously, metadata sounds like a lecture on library sciences, but you're saying this is actually where the action is.
I am. And actually, let's stick with that library analogy because it is perfect for this.
Right, let's hear it.
Imagine the video footage, the story, the characters, the action. Imagine that as a book. Metadata is the librarian.
The librarian.
Right. It is the architecture of the library itself. It's the invisible system that decides whether that book gets placed in the front window with a spotlight on it.
Or if it gets shoved in a back room somewhere.
Exactly. Or locked in a damp basement where nobody has the key. Or, and this is the really scary part, if it gets thrown into the shredder after 30 days because a computer algorithm decided it wasn't, quote unquote, important.
Wow, that is a terrifying image. So the metadata essentially has more power than the actual content of the book.
Precisely. Because if the librarian decides the book doesn't exist, nobody reads it. It doesn't matter what's on the pages.
Right.
And today, we are going to look at the manual for that library. We are doing a deep dive into a really fascinating and frankly kind of disturbing report titled "Metadata is Power: How the Invisible Layer Controls Public Truth."
Right, by Eric Sanders, published just this month, February 2026.
That's the one.
And the mission for this deep dive is pretty clear. We want to move you all beyond the pixels. We
Yes.
want to understand how digital evidence is governed, routed, and controlled without anyone ever having to open, video editing software.
We want to expose that invisible layer. And specifically for this conversation, we're going to zero in on something called classification metadata.
Classification.
Yeah.
I mean, that just sounds like administrative filing.
It looks like filing. But as we'll see today, it is actually a master switch. A simple administrative label, like choosing routine from a drop-down menu instead of force, can be the literal difference between a file surviving to vindicate someone or disappearing completely.
Okay, let's unpack this because
Yeah.
I think most of us, when we hear the phrase body camera, we think of it as an objective witness.
Sure.
It's a robot, it just records what it sees. Why can't we just trust the video?
Because a body-worn camera program isn't just a camera,
Okay.
it is a record-making system. And that is a massive distinction. When you hold your phone up to record a concert, you are just filming. When a government agency runs a camera program, they're operating a complex industrial pipeline. Sanders calls it the control gates.
Control gates, walk me through those.
There are five of them. Think of them as checkpoints that every single file must pass through to survive:
Okay.
capture, classification, preservation, access, and timing. At every single gate, there is a decision made, usually by metadata, that shapes the public truth.
So capture is just, was the camera turned on?
Right. But even that is a metadata question. Did the recording start late? Did it end early?
Oh, I see.
Then you have classification. What do we label this video? Preservation? Are we keeping it on the server or deleting it? access who gets to log in and see it, and timing, when does the public actually get to know it exists?
And your point, or Sanders' point, is that the video clip, the thing we see on the news, is just the output. But the metadata is what we're actually being asked to trust.
Exactly. The clip is what you see. The metadata is the proof that what you're seeing is real, that it's complete, and that it hasn't been messed with.
Right.
Without metadata, transparency is essentially conditional. It's the government handing you a file and saying, here's a video. Trust us, this is everything that happened.
And trust us isn't exactly a rigorous legal standard.
No, it is not.
Yeah.
And let's talk about gaps for a second. You know when you see a video online that starts 10 seconds after the shouting has already started? Or where the audio just mysteriously cuts out?
Oh, all the time. And usually the internet just fills in those blanks with whatever theory fits their particular bias.
Right, the speculation just runs absolutely wild. But metadata turns those gaps from matters of speculation into matters of fact.
How?
Well, metadata can tell you why the recording started late. Was it a system lag? Or did the officer physically wait to hit the button? Was the audio cut manually by someone in the system, or did the battery just fail?
So the metadata is essentially the black box flight recorder for the video itself.
That is a perfect analogy, yes. And this brings us to a major shift in mindset. Mm. We need civic literacy regarding metadata. We need to stop asking, what does the video show, and start asking, who owns the truth?
Right. Is it the viewer, or is it the system that decided what the viewer even gets to see?
Exactly.
That is heavy. But let's get really specific here. Because you mentioned classification metadata is our main focus today. You called it a master switch.
Yes. This is really the core of our deep dive today. And honestly, it is the most crucial part to understand. This is where the whole game of digital evidence is won or lost.
Okay, so classification. In my mind, this is like when I save a document on my laptop, I put it in the work folder or maybe the personal folder.
Right.
It's just clerical housekeeping so I can find it later. Why is this a governance issue?
Because in a massive digital system, like a police department's database, tagging is not housekeeping. Tagging is governance.
Tagging is governance.
Yes. The tag you apply to a file is a literal instruction to the computer system determining that file's destiny.
Its destiny. That sounds a little dramatic.
It is dramatic. I mean, think of it as the legal identity of the file. A video file isn't born as evidence.
It's not.
No, it's just data.
Yeah.
Just ones and zeros on a hard drive. It does not become evidence until a human, or sometimes an automated system, gives it a name.
Like tagging it.
Right. Tagging it arrest or stop, training, use of force.
And that name dictates the rules that apply to it going forward.
Completely. Let's do a side-by-side comparison to make this real. This is straight from Sanders' report.
Okay, let's do it.
I want you to imagine we have two video files. They are identical twins, same length, same camera quality, same exact street content.
Yeah.
They both show an interaction between an officer and a citizen.
Got it. Twin files.
Now let's tag twin A as routine. Maybe the officer categorizes it in the system as a wellness check or a traffic stop, no enforcement.
Okay.
And let's tag twin B as use of force.
Routine versus force. So what happens to twin A, the file tagged routine?
Several things, and all of them are bad for public transparency. First, let's look at retention. A routine file is put on a very short cycle.
Why?
Because police servers fill up incredibly fast. Video is heavy data, so the system is actively programmed to purge low-value data to save server space and taxpayer money. That routine video might be automatically shredded by the software in 30, 60, or 90 days.
Wow. So if a citizen comes forward 4 months later with a formal complaint saying, hey, that officer was abusive during that wellness check.
The video's already gone.
Just gone.
Poof. And the department can honestly say to the press, we didn't destroy evidence. The system simply followed its standard retention policy.
That is wild. Okay, what else happens to the routine file?
Supervision. A routine tag means there is no automatic trigger in the system.
Okay.
It bypasses internal affairs completely.
Mm.
It bypasses the patrol sergeant's review queue. It just drops into the massive digital archive and sits there unwatched.
So it is totally invisible to the bosses.
Correct. And it's invisible to the lawyers, too. This brings us to discovery.
Right, the legal phase.
If a civil rights lawyer sues the department and formally searches the database for use of force incidents on that specific date, Twin A does not appear in the results. It effectively does not exist.
Because the search algorithm is looking for the administrative tag, not analyzing the actual video content.
Exactly. The computer doesn't watch the video to see if there was a shove or a punch.
Yeah.
It just reads the tag.
Unbelievable.
And finally, audit scrutiny. minimal. It is treated as low-value data. Nobody is checking the logs to see who watched it or who accessed it because nobody cares about a routine file.
It's just buried under millions of other routine files.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's look at TwinB, the file where the exact same footage was tagged, use of force.
Total opposite destiny. Let's run through the same four categories. Retention, it's immediately flagged for survival. It might be kept for 20 years or permanently. The system automatically puts a legal hold on it.
Because the tag tells it to.
Right. Supervision. The literal moment the force tag is applied, the system routes it to a supervisor or a civilian oversight body. A notification actually pops up on a lieutenant's screen saying, new use of force incident requires review.
So eyes are on it immediately.
Yes, within hours.
Yeah.
Discovery. Yep. It has incredibly high visibility. It pops up instantly in critical incident searches by attorneys or journalists.
Right.
And audit scrutiny. The system treats TwinB as high integrity evidence. It meticulously logs every single person who clicks on it, every time they pause it, every time they share it.
So just to be absolutely clear here, the pixels in both videos are identical. The actual street content is exactly the same. But the label, this tiny administrative drop-down menu choice, decides if the file survives to be seen in a courtroom or if it just vanishes into the ether.
Exactly. The label determines the reality. The metadata is the master switch.
That is an incredible amount of power to hide inside a drop-down menu.
It really is.
But here's where my skeptical brain goes immediately. What if the tag changes? I mean, can you change the tag after the fact?
Yeah.
You absolutely can. And this is where we get into what Sanders calls defensive governance.
Defensive governance. That sounds like a very polite, academic way of saying cover up.
Well, it's subtle. See, administrative systems fundamentally need the ability to correct errors. You can't lock a system down completely.
Right. Mistakes happen.
Exactly. Sometimes an officer tags something as an arrest, but the charges get dropped by the DA the next day, so a clerk goes in and retags it. That is a completely valid administrative function.
Okay, I see that.
But without a transparent audit trail, we don't know if a tag change was a routine clerical correction or a deliberate defensive strategy.
Give me a concrete example of how this could be used strategically, like maliciously.
Okay. Imagine a body cam video that captures a really questionable shove by an officer against a civilian. In the heat of the moment, or maybe even flagged by an automated Taser deployment sensor, it gets originally tagged as force.
So it's in the system. It's flagged.
It's flagged. It's sitting in the sergeant's review queue. But then, a few days later, someone, maybe that supervisor or maybe the officer themselves logging back in, goes into the software and retags it as routine.
And suddenly it just falls off the review queue.
It drops right off the queue. And crucially, it immediately enters that purge cycle we talked about.
Yeah.
The clock starts ticking toward automatic deletion.
Wow.
Or consider this scenario, which Sanders highlights. A file is intentionally tagged to the wrong incident number.
So it's just misfiled, like putting a paper file in the wrong cabinet.
Right. A typo. But now, if a journalist files a public records request for incident number 12345, the database search returns zero results. The institution can stand at a press conference and say, we thoroughly searched our systems for that incident and found no video.
And they aren't technically lying.
No. They're telling a flawless technical truth based on the tags while creating a massive substantive lie.
That's insidious.
Sanders calls this the gaslighting effect. The community knows the video exists. Witnesses saw the camera blinking on the officer's chest, but the department says it doesn't exist. And the metadata, the tagging architecture, is the invisible shield they are hiding behind.
Because they altered the map.
Exactly. As the report says, the map changes and the map determines what appears.
That is terrifying. It's literally using bureaucracy as a weapon.
It is. And it brings us right to the next layer of the deep dive. If tagging is the governance, how do we ever prove what happened behind the scenes?
Right. How do we catch them changing the map?
We need to talk about the audit log.
The audit log. This is section 3 of Sanders' framework. He calls this the digital chain of custody.
Yes. And we really need to dispel a major Hollywood myth here before we go further.
Which one?
In movies, when the bad guys want to tamper with digital evidence, you always see them in some dark server room hacking the actual video file. They're splicing frames, looping footage of an empty hallway.
Right, right. Like in that movie Speed, loop the tape.
Exactly. Loop the tape. But in reality, nobody does that.
They don't.
No, it is way too technically difficult. And forensic digital experts can spot a spliced video file in about 10 seconds. You do not need to edit the video to control the narrative. You use workflow control.
Workflow control, what does that actually look like in practice?
It looks like viewing the footage before you write your official police report. Think about that.
So you tailor your written story to match exactly what the camera saw. And wait, more importantly, you tailor it to match what the camera missed.
Precisely. If you are an officer and you know the camera didn't catch your first physical strike because the lens was pointed the other way during a struggle, you can leave that strike out of your written report with absolute confidence.
Because you know there's no visual evidence to contradict you.
Right. That's workflow control. Or it looks like the public relations department delaying the disclosure of a video until the internal stin is completely solidified. Or it looks like exporting only a carefully selected 30-second segment for the evening news instead of releasing the full hour of context.
So how does the audit log catch this kind of manipulation?
Well, the audit log is a time-stamped, unalterable record of every single human and system interaction with that specific file. It is the digital fingerprints on the evidence.
So it literally lists who watched it.
Yes. It records view events. Officer Smith watched this file on Tuesday at 3:00 a.m. It records edit events. Sergeant Jones changed the classification tag from force to routine at 4:15 a.m.
Wow.
And it records export events. Detective Davis copied this file to an external USB drive at 5:00 a.m.
And the time, the chronology of those events is the real key here.
Chronology is power. The sequence matters far more than the event itself. For example, did the classification tag change after a local journalist filed a records request?
Ooh, that looks incredibly bad.
It looks like a cover-up. Or did the officer watch the body cam video before or after they filed their sworn incident report?
Right.
Because if the audit log shows they sat at their desk, watched the video 10 times, paused it frame by frame, and then wrote the report, that report is no longer an independent recollection of a human being. It is a script reverse-engineered from the video.
It's the black box of the bureaucracy. If you don't have that audit log, you're just guessing.
Exactly. And that is why Sanders argues forcefully that the audit log is arguably more important evidence than the video itself in a legal dispute.
That's a huge claim.
But it makes sense. The video just shows what happened on the street. The audit log shows what the system did to the truth.
Man. Now, we've been talking a lot about the camera itself, the actual video file, but section 4 of this deep dive reminds us that the body camera is really just one piece of a much larger puzzle.
Right. We need to expand the scope here. We're not just dealing with the body-worn camera or the BWC. We are dealing with an entire ecosystem of evidence. Sanders calls it the digital shadow record.
The digital shadow record sounds a bit ominous, honestly.
It reflects the reality that in 2026, every single police encounter creates a massive, sprawling digital footprint across multiple, totally unconnected computer systems.
So even if the camera is, quote unquote, accidentally turned off, the shadow is still there.
Exactly. The shadow remains.
What are the specific components of this shadow?
We'll start with CAD computer-aided dispatch. This is the objective start of any timeline. When was the 911 call actually created? When was the specific unit dispatched by radio?
Okay, so that's the central dispatch log, hard data.
Right. Then you have the MDT, the mobile data terminal. That's the rugged laptop mounted in the center console of the police cruiser.
What does that tell us?
It tells us what the officer was searching for before the encounter even happened.
Oh, that goes straight to state of mind.
Yes. If they were typing in searches for a stolen vehicle versus searching for a specific named suspect, that completely changes the legal context of the stop.
Or if they looked up the person's mugshot in criminal history before they even put the car in park.
Exactly. Then you add in GPS and vehicle telemetry. Where was the cruiser exactly? Down to the meter. How fast were they driving? Did they hit the brakes hard? And finally, don't forget department-issued phones.
The back channel.
Right. The text messages, the encrypted app usage between officers, mm-hmm. the coordination that happens off the radio.
So if the video is missing or if it starts suspiciously late, you can use these other data points to essentially draw a box around the missing truth.
It's called triangulation. Mm. If the body cam video starts late, you don't just throw up your hands. You check the CAD logs.
Right.
When did the officer actually arrive on the scene?
Right.
If the dispatch log says they arrived at 10:00 p.m., but the camera wasn't activated until 10:05 p.m., that five-minute gap is a massive red flag. You can prove the gap exists.
And if the written report says one thing, but the MDT logs show they were researching something completely different on their laptop.
You catch them in a verifiable contradiction, as Sanders puts it in the report. If the clip is unclear, follow the timestamps. The digital shadow almost always reveals the truth that the video lens missed.
That makes a lot of sense. It's putting together a puzzle where the video is just the centerpiece, but the edge pieces are all metadata.
Beautifully put.
But let's talk about the weaponization of time itself. Section 5 of the report calls this timing as a weapon.
This is critical. We so often think of transparency as a simple binary of access. Do we get to see the file or not?
Right. Yes or no.
But when we get the file matters just as much as if we get it.
You're talking about the first narrative advantage.
Yes. The first story told, which is almost always a press release by the institution, becomes the baseline truth in the public consciousness. It anchors our understanding of the event.
Even if that first story turns out to be completely wrong months later.
Exactly. Because by the time the correction comes out, by the time the actual raw footage is released, the news cycle has moved on. Nobody is paying attention. And institutions are acutely aware of this dynamic.
So they use it.
They do. They use what Sanders calls the clip trap.
The clip trap. Explain that.
It's the strategic release of a highly curated, very short fragment of video early in a crisis. Just the specific 15 seconds that justify the officer's actions.
So it creates an illusion of transparency. They can say, look, we're being open. We released the video.
Right. But they released a fragment, a sliver of context.
And then they delay the release of the rest of the footage for as long as legally possible.
And that delay is incredibly destructive to justice. While we wait 6 months for the full video, witness memories naturally fade. Third-party video like CCTV from a nearby bodega or someone's Ring doorbell gets automatically overwritten. The institutional narrative just hardens like concrete.
It creates this toxic paradox. Sanders calls it conditional transparency. If the full truth only ever comes out after massive public pressure, after costly lawsuits, after months and months of administrative delay,
then the public learns to fundamentally distrust everything, even when the police are actually telling the truth.
Oh, yeah.
If you always have to fight tooth and nail just to see the public record, you naturally assume the record is being hidden for a nefarious reason.
And this isn't just theoretical philosophy, right? Sanders brings some really hard data into this section to back it up.
He does. He cites a massive audit conducted by the New York City Comptroller. And the numbers are just staggering.
Hit me with the stats.
In the data set they audited, looking at critical incidents, footage was simply not on file for 36% of the incidents.
Over a third. Over a third of the time, there's just no video.
Gone. Or never existed. And even when the video was on file, instances of late activation or early deactivation occurred in 18% of cases.
So almost one in five of the surviving videos had a major gap issue.
Yes. But here is the real kicker regarding timing. The average time it took the department to process a standard Freedom of Information request for footage, 133 business days.
Business days. That's what? That's over half a calendar year?
And that's just the average. The range for fulfilling requests extended all the way up to 4 years, over 1,000 business days.
That is absurd. Imagine trying to get legal justice for a civil rights violation that happened 4 years ago.
You can't.
The memory is gone. The witnesses have moved away. The case is stone cold.
Exactly. And here's one last statistic from that audit that basically proves the administrative system is broken by design. 97% of appeals were granted.
Wait, explain the mechanics of that.
It means the department initially denied the citizen's request for the video. The citizen formally appealed that denial. And 97% of the time, a higher authority looked at it and said, actually, yes, you are legally entitled to have this.
So the initial denial was totally bogus.
It proves the initial denial was never a valid legal decision. It was a pressure filter. They deny it right out of the gate just to see if you'll get exhausted and give up.
That is deeply cynical. It's basically a policy of no, unless you really, really mean it and have a lawyer.
Exactly. It's weaponized friction.
Okay, so we've painted a pretty grim picture here today. The invisible metadata layer controls the actual truth. Classification tags can bury crucial evidence. Audit logs are kept hidden in the black box. Delays are completely rampant. How on earth do we fix this? What is the actual solution?
Section 6 of the report gives us a really solid roadmap. Sanders says we need to fundamentally shift our society from a culture of compliance theater, where institutions just pretend to follow transparency rules, to a verification culture.
Verification culture. Okay. What does that demand look like in practice?
The new baseline demand standard for any journalist, any defense lawyer, or just any concerned citizen asking for digital evidence must change. It has to be. Content plus handling history.
Meaning don't just ask for the video.
Never just ask for the MP4 file. Ask the map. Ask for the librarian's records. Sanders lays out the five integrity gates we need to systematically verify every single time.
Let's run through those gates as demands.
Number one, capture integrity. Don't just show me the video clip. Prove to me exactly when it started and stopped. I want to see the raw activation log from the camera hardware.
Okay, prove it wasn't manipulated on the street.
Number two, classification integrity. This ties back to our core focus today. Prove the tagging history to me. Show me the log of who labeled this file as routine and show me if that label was ever altered by a supervisor post-incident.
Right. Verify the master switch wasn't flipped. Number three.
Preservation integrity. Prove that legal holds were placed on the data. Show me the automated retention schedule for this specific file so I know you aren't running out the clock to purge it.
Hold them to the server rules. Number four.
Access integrity. Prove to me who watched this video and exactly when they watched it. This is the absolute critical one for preventing workflow collusion in police report writing.
Show me the digital fingerprints. And the final one, number five.
Timing integrity. Prove the timeline of your production versus my request. If it took you 133 days to hand this over, show me the internal administrative log that justifies that delay.
I love the summary quote Sanders gives in this section. He says, "A video without an audit trail is a story the government wants you to watch, not a record the public can verify."
Yeah, that is definitely the quote of the episode right there. It perfectly encapsulates the entire problem.
It really reframes everything we think we know about digital evidence. So as we wrap up this deep dive, let's synthesize all this for everyone listening.
I think the main takeaway is this. Metadata is the master switch that controls the life and death of public evidence. For the last 10 years, we have been so intensely focused on the camera lens, demanding more cameras, more pixels, that we totally forgot to look at the server room.
We forgot about the librarian.
Exactly.
So the next time you see a viral news clip or a highly produced police release of body cam footage on social media,
don't just passively watch the action on the screen. Start asking the deeper, invisible questions. Where is the audit log? Who labeled this file? When was it actually released compared to when it happened? And what is the digital shadow record saying that this lens isn't showing us?
It's really about becoming a much smarter, more skeptical consumer of the quote-unquote truth.
It is. We have to demand the architecture, not just the content.
I want to leave everyone with a final, slightly provocative thought drawn from the source material. It really stuck with me after reading it.
This year.
Public ownership of data means the government must be able to produce the chain of title for the truth. If they cannot logically prove the record's history, then the record isn't actually public. It is just institutional property.
An incredibly powerful way to put it.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. Keep digging.
Keep digging.